Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 272 of the Board Game Barbecue podcast, brought to you by Advent Games and our Patreons. My name is Lauren, and I'm joined today in the Peanut Gallery with a whole slew of hosts. So I've got with me Connor. How's it going, Connor?
I'm good. Thanks, Loz. I thought you were going to say with a whole bunch of peanuts because, look, I generally think of highly of one of these people, but the other one, not so much.
Well, we'll leave you guys to guess who is who. I'm also joined by Def. Def, how you doing, mate?
I'm good, Lauren. How are you? The conversation's derailed already.
You have a 50-50% chance of being a moron, according to a moron. So don't worry about it.
So I would know, right? Like minds.
So also joined, no surprises, by Adrian. Eddie, how you going, mate?
I am good. I'm very good, actually. We had a bit of a late night last night playing Jackbox games, which was probably one of the most insane Jackbox games I think I've ever played. It was Connor was actually on my team for one of them. Have you played much Jackbox, Lauren?
I have played a few of the games, but I've not been able to come to any of these Patreon parties, so I'm really keen to hear about it.
Oh, man. We played Quicksort, and I'm not sure if anyone's familiar with this, but you split into two teams.
Don't even. I'm still mad.
Okay, sorry, but we split into two teams, and Jonathan, JT, had won like a bunch of games. He's pretty good at this stuff. He's very good at like subtly lying so that we end up getting the wrong answers. So me, Dan, and Connor, the three hosts that were there, jumped onto his team somehow. So we were like, this is going to be a winner. JT's going to take us to victory. Little did he know, we just dragged him so far down, it was impossible to win. So the other team, Team Cheese, they were called Team Cheese, they had to rearrange the lyrics for I Will Survive, okay, in order, of which they scored a perfect 9 out of 9, a 9 streak. So they nailed it, and it was so good. It was like amazing to see. Everyone was excited. So it was our turn, and our team had to do How to Kiss. We had to put into order different motions, movements, actions on the structure of a kiss.
It was the worst.
I'll read them out because they are – I'm going to read them out because it blew my mind. Okay. This is the correct order as well. Okay. Keep your lips soft. Do a few soft kisses. Manage saliva levels. This is one of my favorites. It has got like in speech bubbles, lock lips.
Yeah,
lock within
quotation marks. Yeah.
And it's make sure to breathe. Don't forget breathing. Whatever you do, if you forget to breathe, you're out. And this is the one that confused me because I was like, use your hands.
What?
Use your hands. Like, I'm guessing to hold your partner. I get that, but I'd put that closer to the end if that's me. Then it's test using tongue. then it's try French kissing, and then number 9, which is the best one, just mix it up. There you go. And we were so wrong. Ours, we got 2 out of the 9. Everything else was just a nightmare. It was so bad.
Do you know where the steps came from, though, AD? Like where the program got the steps from?
They got them from How Wiki, like How to Kiss on Wiki.
Yeah, so if you know Wiki How, it's like the most dank, like broken, like website. And I was just imagining the pictures that they have on Wiki How of demonstrating each of these steps as well. Like, oh man, if it wasn't so funny, I would have been furious, proper furious. They had I Will Survive, but everyone knows, like you would know that song off by heart. And we had this step. But to top it off, our second one was we had to put in order from like least funny to hilarious cartoon injuries. So it's like, what are the, like, it's like, exactly.
What?
And what did they have?
They had another factual one when it was like it was named actors names in alphabetical order. Yeah. They would give you the characters they play, so they would give you Forrest Gump. So you're like, oh, Tom Hanks, H, somewhere close to the middle. Whereas we had banana peel,
James Gandolfini. Yeah,
we had banana peel, painted wall, butt catching fire, getting inflated, catapulted in the air. It's like we had no chance. Like the hilarity of it and the funniness, there's no scale. It's like a spectrum of like what I find funny might not be as funny to Connor. So we had no bearing. It was insane. And everyone was laughing. MJ was running interference going, that's way more funnier. That's not funny. Yeah. And causing havoc. But it was such a good night. Like it was really fun. So I really enjoy those Patreon nights.
Yeah, they're really good. If you're, you know, if you can come along and get involved and you're a Patreon, they are. Jace runs it so well. He does a bang up job. So thanks again to Jace for like coming up with the idea, you know, all those years ago and then running them. So thank you for doing that. And thank you for all the Patreons that came along. It was an absolute blast.
Oh, that sounds absolutely awesome. I really need to try to get to one of these. Because otherwise, how am I going to know how to kiss? I just... Connor, what have you been playing, mate?
What have I been playing? Well, I've actually been on BGA a fair bit. I've been playing a couple of games solo because... I won't tell you why and when I've been playing them because it might compromise my employment. So I've been playing Feast for Odin solo on BGA, which has been really, really, really cool. So it's for those of you who, first of all, haven't played Feast for Odin, it's a Uwe
Rosenberg
game. I know. And it is really testing my friendship with you, Def, the fact that you haven't played them. Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah. Lauren's disgusted at both of you. Like,
appalled.
But it's – so the great thing about these Rosenberg games is the solo mode is pretty much just – their game, and they just it's just got a bot that imitates taking these worker placements. But what A Feast for Odin is kind of famous for is it's like 64 or whatever worker placement spots. So it's like that whole thing of, well, what am I going to do? But the way that it works is you're effectively taking maybe like what, like 8 different actions, and there's just a scale of how many Vikings or workers you need to put onto each of them. So it's not as if it's 64 different or however many it is, totally different actions. It's the same similar type of action. So you're going hunting or you're going pillaging or you're going to market and so on and so forth. So it's an absolute classic. It's so fun. I love treating it like a big puzzle and trying to maximize, you know, The aim is to cover up effectively as much of your board as you can with goods, because you start off with a negative score and you're trying to push it up to a positive score. But probably, and you've still got that whole thing of we got to feed your workers, but weirdly you can feed them money. Like, so here you go, here's a gold coin. Go, I don't know, what are you gonna do? Like, test if there's chocolate inside with the. It's actually a chocolate coin. But one of the really cool things is just how much you can do in the game. Like, what do you think, Lauren? Like, I think it's almost like it's sandboxy, really, about how much you can do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the Norwegians expansion, I'm not sure if that's on BGA, really makes all of those different options viable. I heard, and I'm not good enough at this game to know this, but that whaling and I think sailing to other islands is made better, more balanced with the expansion. But what I really like about it is because, yeah, you're trying to cover up your board to avoid taking negative points. So there's a really kind of obvious ceiling that you're trying to hit. And I see these photos of these games people upload where they've covered their entire board and then the boards of two other islands that they've taken up. How are you? I can't even, half my board is visible.
Yeah.
So I really like that I can see how good you can get at it. I can see how kind of efficient you can get at the game. So that kind of desire to get there keeps me coming back to it.
Yeah. And in the so with the goods that you put on your board, you can't put goods of the same color on top of or next to each other. The only way that that breaks is by using the blue goods, which are effectively treasure. So you can get treasure, which is quite expensive. So you can get that rating. And most of them are either a rectangular array or a square array, except for these treasures, which are kind of a non-traditional array. They're made up of different weird shapes, and that helps you plug different gaps, because with the income spaces, you cannot place on an income space unless you've covered the previous one below it or to the left. So it's a really good way to sort of cover those up. But yeah, trying to go and grab those islands and maximize your score is super, super fun. I remember talking to Mitch, and Mitch said, you can't win that game unless you migrate. You've got to migrate, because what that does is that reduces the number of Vikings you have to then feed. So that's a really, really good strategy. But yeah, no, it's really good. Def, I think you would like this game. I really do, because it is very, very puzzly. It is a little bit solo multiplayer, except for the fact that you're trying to sort of get to those worker placements first. But yeah. We'll have to tee one up.
I definitely need to play this at some point.
I would definitely like to try it again, because I've only played it once and I definitely felt a little lackluster playing it. Like, I was like, it's fine, but I wasn't enamored. I wasn't like, got to play this again. Oh, I got to buy it. Mm. Like, I just was like, this is cool. But that's as far as I ever went. But it could be that whole thing of playing a game with all these different avenues just the once and then not seeing the whole puzzle. Do you know what I mean? And playing it again.
I don't know. I haven't had much luck with the Rosenberg farming games in the past. So we'll see if this one's an exception. But yeah, keen to try it.
You've been playing some other solo games as well on BGA, Connor?
Yeah, man. Spreadsheet the game. Hadrian's Wall. So good. Man, it's so fun. And with Hadrian's Wall, I would always get halfway and be like, I've totally stuffed this big time, like majorly stuffed this.
Yep.
But because it was on paper, I'd be forced to play out the game knowing that I'd ruined it, because I didn't want to waste the paper. So I was like, I don't want to waste this sheet, so I'm going to play this out.
Yeah.
With BGA,
there's so many sheets in that game.
It doesn't matter, right? They're all precious to me. And I know I can photocopy them and laminate them, but whatever. Like, just don't at me. So, but now with BGA, I could just quit that game and then start another one. It's like, yes, I could start afresh. I don't need to worry about wasting paper or whatever. It's environmentally friendly too. Like, big thumbs up. But yeah, the combinations, again, I think what I like about both of these games is there's so many options available to you, so many different ways that you can go about winning. Now, I know, kind of like what you said, Lauren, there probably is an optimum way to play. But for me, that's not my bag. Like, I'm not pushing for the highest possible score. I'm just experimenting. It's allowed me to go through different routes that I never used before. So, for example, I'd never really used the gladiators.
Mm.
But now I get to try them out and see what works and whatnot. I get to push different tracks up or try and, you know, complete different sections of the left-hand page, even though it doesn't really matter. So the wall page, and really push for those roads. It is that sort of type. It's that game where it's, you know, I pull a lever and I get something to come out, or I pull another lever and I get two items or what have you. And it just sort of, you know, it's a great thing to have in the background if you want a bit of a brain break or whatever. But I haven't talked to you about Hadrian's Wall, Loz. Do you like it? Have you played it?
Yeah, I will say that I am the least lucky with the invasions I think you can possibly yes. get. You're like, all right,
yes.
Okay, I can protect one in three. There is a 33.3% chance, never goes my way. But outside of that, yeah, it's great. What's not to like? I really enjoy playing it in person because I just like colouring in the boxes. I like collecting and fiddling with all the little meatballs. I got the stickers for them. And I haven't tried this one on BGA much, mostly because it's so easy to set up in person.
Sure, yep.
For sure, Feast for Odin, smash it out on BGA because it takes up a whole table. It takes 20 minutes to set up, but these are both great. And I understand you've been playing something else that Def is going to have no thoughts on whatsoever.
I don't know where to start with this game, to be honest with you, because Def said it all the other week with Voidfall. It's, Yeah. When you were talking about it, Def, I honestly still, what I got from your, I guess let's call it a review or talking about it, was how passionate you were. And that passion sort of came through. And because my mind's eye is so limited, I couldn't create the image of it in my brain. And then when I played it, I totally got all of that. You know, that action selection with the cards, the choice of where you're going to go, the whole idea of the miniatures aren't actually miniatures, it's your fleet number, and having to defend against the void and that constant. And then even, I know you sort of said, oh, it's closer to a Euro than a 4X, which you're right, but it's still got those 4X elements. You know, you can set up your position so that only one section is getting invaded by the void, depending on which scenario you're playing. You've got the upgrading, and I know when I played with you and Harry, there was an area that I definitely didn't maximize, and it left me kind of in the dirt. But I love pushing up for the technologies. That was really cool. I thought initially, I was like, oh, the technologies don't seem that vast, but they are super game-changing. Like, it really, totally changes everything. I had the missiles, and having the missiles just made defeating void or moving into enemy territory so much easier. I could imagine if you're sort of fighting against each other, you could be like, oh, I'm going to have to get extra shields, or I'm going to have to get missiles myself. So having that was really, really cool. I liked that each of our tracks moving up on our personal tracks were different. That really makes me excited. Yeah, it's definitely... And you explained it all, as you do in most cases. You do a really, really good job. It's so straightforward once you get going. The only thing that you have to go back and check really is the combat. But I actually don't mind that, because it means that there's variety within the actions you can take. It's fully determined. You don't have to roll dice or anything like that. You know what the result's going to be when you go through, but you still want to check off all those things to make sure that, A, you're losing fleet or power.
Yeah, you run through the steps.
And you're doing it properly because it is predetermined, you need to get that right. But yeah, oh, I mean, what more can I say after your glowing praise of it the other week?
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it, and just looking forward to see if you keep the same opinion after playing it a few more times. But it's a beast of a game to table. So
it's so good.
So have you just played it once, Connor, or have you managed to table it a few times?
No, I only played it once, but I keep getting pictures of Def playing it, so I feel like I've experienced many of them.
Same thing.
I know. So Harry, who we played with, also played it with his friend as well. And we just had such great discussions afterwards too about the mechanics, all that type of stuff. It was really, really cool, and I'm grateful that Def taught it to me. And even to the point where I think I could easily teach this to a couple of my brothers who might be interested in this type of game. As soon as we finished, I said, over Christmas time, we're playing this. It's going to be great. You guys are going to love it. So I'm actually looking forward to that. Maybe on one of the slow days over the Christmas period, I can bust it out with them and we can, you know, set it up over an afternoon or something like that.
Ah, that sounds absolutely awesome. That's awesome. Yeah, I need to give this one a try. Just visually, it's so striking.
I think you'd really like it. Like, the mix of 4X and Euro is something that you would really enjoy.
Yeah. I mean, I love Eclipse, so.
Yeah, sure, well, yeah, there you go.
Def, what have you been playing, mate?
I've been playing mostly small games lately, like, you know, Sky Team and Dracula versus Van Helsing and a couple of other small games.
I thought you were going to say small games, you know, on Mars, you know, Mr. President.
He did this morning.
I did play on Mars this morning, and that was awesome. But
is Dracula versus Van Helsing, is that the trick taker one?
Yes.
The two player. That's a great game. I really enjoyed that. I played it with Mitch's house, and yeah, I really, really, really enjoyed it. It was great. All the powers that change. I have no idea.
I've only played on Board Game Arena. I don't think it's actually been released yet.
I think so.
You played a physical copy
from abroad. Yeah, yeah. I'm pretty sure. Maybe, or maybe I played the other one. There's another bloody Van Helsing game or something that we played. It's very similar to that, where it's like two player trick taking game. but you move up a track. Oh, it's, no, it's not. It's Hyde.
Jekyll and Hyde. Bloody Jekyll versus Hyde.
Jekyll and Hyde.
No, that's not
Jekyll
it.
Jekyll versus Hyde.
Different game.
Yeah, different game. Completely different mythical.
You got your Victorian era horror wrong.
Yeah. I've done that before as well. I've done the same mistake at a different point.
But the game I wanted to talk about a little bit about is a game I played for the first time, which is Forbidden Stars. So I know of this game. I knew of this game, but I haven't had a chance to play it. Area Control is not really my jam. I don't mind playing area control games. But this one obviously has a big legacy behind it with StarCraft, and now this sort of retheme or remake around the Warhammer universe, I guess. And so we had a three-player game the other day, and it has some very interesting mechanics in it. So at the start of each round, players have these tokens that they place face down in different sectors of the map. And there's two copies of each token. And basically these are like commands that you place, and then they start getting resolved in turn order. But you can place tokens on top of other people's tokens in these sectors, so they stack, which means if you place a couple of tokens and I place mine above, you can't resolve yours until I resolve mine and stuff like that. So I thought that was very clever. Then the actual combat, the way the combat works is very interesting. You have a bunch of units in combat, and they each have like health and how much damage they do, but they also have a third statistic, which is morale. And what happens is, as you go through the combat, then at the end of each phase, if you know the combat only lasts three phases, so you either have to eliminate your opponent until the end of the three phases, but if you don't, and that happens more often than not, at least in our game it did, what happens then is you count the amount of morale that each side has, and whoever has the most morale wins the combat. So in some cases, we had a lot of combats where one of the players knew they couldn't win the combat by elimination, but they, you know, they kept defending to stay alive and win by, you know, using their morale. But you play these cards that add different things. They can change your dice. They can add additional, you know, shields or morale on top of the morale that your units have, and etc. I thought it was interesting. So some very good ideas in the game, but two things. One, I thought it was way too long for what it was. I thought it dragged on, you know, I think it was 8 rounds, and I thought it was like 4 rounds too long. It was really long. And
how long did the actual game go for, though? The actual game itself?
3 hours, 3.5 hours, maybe.
Yeah, okay.
But it felt really long. Like, it didn't. I don't mind playing long games, obviously, like as you know. But
yeah,
it just felt like it really dragged on, because the way you try to win the game is you have to try and go grab these objectives that other players have seeded in other parts of the map, and obviously the other players will also try to grab their objectives, which usually will be on your side of the map. But they also want to defend the objectives that you're after, and they're on their side and stuff like that. Like, I think the main mechanics of the game are really interesting. It has a couple of pitfalls. Like I said, I think it drags on a bit. And the second thing is the combats, even though they're very interesting, they're very long. They have massive downtime. And the first couple of times you're excited to see what's happening between the other players, but after a couple of combats, you kind of like disengage and go, come on, let's get it over with. You're still going, come on already, you know, like it's a bit of a shame for me. I would like to try it again to see if it flows a bit better, because that was my first game, obviously. But I mean, the game's not complex, so I don't think that slowed us down much. It has some really interesting and cool thing it does. You have a deck of 10 cards, and you one of the actions you can do in the game is upgrade your cards, and you get better cards that have more, you know, attack or defense icons or morale, or they do cool stuff. So the combat manipulation, it reminded me a bit of Heroes of Air, Land and Sea. Same sort of kind of system, but I thought this was actually more interesting. So, yeah, interesting game. I would like to try it again. I don't know if any of you guys have played it.
I haven't. I've played Chaos in the Old World with Gene at one of the Melbourne Game Days. And, look, I could be totally off base here, but I think it shares some of the same things. Like you talked about the upgrading of the cards, and you can do that in Chaos in the Old World. You've got to move for objectives and so on and so forth. And it's obviously a Warhammer property. I wonder, Def, so it's obviously based off of StarCraft. Whether it's Warhammer 4, is it based off of StarCraft, is it?
Yeah, it's a re-implementation of StarCraft.
Right, but it's for a Warhammer, right? So it's...
correct, so you have the Space Marines.
Yeah, so I'm wondering if part of the reason why it's got this big combat and this long playtime is because lots of people who may purchase this game are Warhammer fans, Warhammer 40k fans, and they're used to really involved long combats where you're doing skill checks, check for armor, check for wounds, and then check for special abilities. So they're used to this sort of long downtime. Now that's normally, you know, 1v1, so you're always involved in the combat. It's not a three-player game generally. And in terms of the length, you know, those games can last for a long time. So the length for those people who may be also purchasing that game may not be an issue as well. They're used to sort of it dragging out or whatever.
Yeah.
But I hadn't realized it was a re-implementation of the StarCraft board game, which that's pretty cool.
Yeah. So I just checked my stats. It did go on for 3.5 hours.
Yeah.
And that was only a three-player game. If it's four players, I'm assuming it will be even longer than that, because it's not as if things will resolve quicker. It's actually adding an additional player's turns, and the turns can be involved.
I guess it's good that you're tempering the positive with the negative, because this game's insanely hard to get, right? Super out of print, People's Grail games, right. $400 on eBay. Yeah.
$400?
Yeah, it's out of print, so people, you know, are selling it at crazy prices. Look, I think I can see why it could be, you know, people's grail game. I can understand why, but it does have, it almost feels to me like it has some, you know, issues from sort of old school game design type of thing. Like, you know, if you play Risk today, it would probably fall behind other area control games that do things in a much more interesting or streamlined way. But it was great, you know, 20, 30 years ago or whatever. This feels like that. There is a couple of things that could be either removed or streamlined somehow. But like I said, I enjoyed the game. I would love to play it again to get a better feel for it, especially at four players. But even at three, I thought it played really well. And a couple of its parts are very, very clever and very interesting.
Well, Def, if you give me $200, I can pay $200, and we can split the cost for a game off of eBay. How's that sound?
Sounds reasonable.
So, because this is a Warhammer game, and often those war games, you know, you basically eradicate another player. Does that happen in this? Can you wipe out a player from the game? So if it was a four-player game, can you wipe a player down so it becomes almost a three-player game? Or is there equal opportunity for someone to, you know, stay in?
No, I don't think so, because you can always produce new units and build. So I haven't thought about that, to be honest. I don't know if that ever happens. It doesn't feel like it does.
I think because people are also scrambling for the objectives around the board, you're not necessarily incentivized to just totally bash on one person.
Yeah, yeah, correct. Because your objective is not to destroy the other players. Your objective is to go and get your
get
missions or your objective tokens. So, yeah, that's Forbidden Stars.
Okay. All right, awesome. Well, thanks for that, guys. Love to hear what people have been playing. I think now we'll move on to some sizzles.
Woo, woo, woo.
So, Def, would you like to kick us off? What is it that you would like to sizzle for us this week?
Yes, this was a kind of a last-minute decision, not because I was indecisive. I'm indecisive anyway, but because when I first played this game, I wasn't impressed with it. And I told Adnan and a friend Adnan, and he said, "Really? This looks like a Def game. That doesn't sound right." And I was like, "Mate, it wasn't good. What can I tell you?" And then I played it again, and I was like, "Yeah, it's still not good." And then I played it again, and then I played it again, and then I played it again. And at some point, Adnan sends me a message and goes, "How many times have you played this game you don't like now?" So this is Sky Mines from Alexander Pfister. This is a re-implementation of a game called Mombasa, which was released about 10 years ago, I want to say. I'm not quite sure. So it's, you know, it's a one of those mid-to-heavy Euro games that Pfister makes. Mombasa, as far as I can tell, has been very successful. And Sky Mines basically is a couple of things. One, it's a complete reskin of Mombasa, but it's exactly the same game. It's exactly the same game, exactly the same rules, maybe a couple of very, very small tweaks, but it's exactly the same game. But it comes with a double-sided board, and on the second side of the board, you can play an evolution of the game with different rules and different kind of setup and things like that. But what the game is, Sky Mines, is you are investors of mining companies that have set up shop on the moon and the asteroids, and they're mining for resources and making profits and stuff like that. And the players represent investors to these companies. And the game works in a similar way to, I want to say, City of the Big Shoulders or 18XX games from the perspective that the investors, the players are investors, and they are separate from the entities in the game. So the companies, there's four companies in the game. And what happens is players use their abilities and their actions to expand these companies. But you don't own the companies. So on your first turn, you could expand one of these companies. On your second turn, you could expand a different company. And when you expand them, these companies become more valuable. And the more valuable the companies are, the more points they're going to score for players at the end of the game based on how many shares each player has in these companies. So it's a very typical sort of economic and investors game where you kind of want to have shares in the most valuable companies, but you cannot ignore the others. You also want to be diversified a bit because you don't exactly know what the other players are going to end up doing. So the game lasts over 7 rounds, and the most satisfying part of the game for me has been the action selection. I think when I think of this, I think of Connor, because I know Connor loves this stuff. I think you would really enjoy this, Connor. The way it works is you have an initial hand of 9 or 10 cards, if I remember correctly, and you have your player board, and your player board has 5 slots at the bottom. Three of those are active and 2 of them are inactive. And what you do is there's a preparation or planning phase at the start where all players in secret decide which 3 cards they want to play this round, and they place them down in these slots face down. So nobody knows what the other players are doing. And you then flip all the cards out for all the players. And then in player turn order, clockwise, each player takes a turn using these cards or using some workers you have to go to different spots on the board to take actions, etc. When everybody passes, after everybody passes, the trick then is that at the top of your board, you have 3 respective slots that have your discard piles. So what you do is first you have to decide one of these discard piles and collect all the cards from that back to your hand And then the cards that you played this round, you have to discard them to those discard piles, but you're restricted to one card per discard pile. So you got to... Yes, you got to plan, what do I want to do next round? I need to have some energy and some minerals, so I better put this energy card to this pile that has a minerals card from my previous discard or whatever. So this part is very satisfying because it almost determines what you can and cannot do. Well, not almost. It 100% determines what you can and cannot do the next upcoming rounds. And it is a game that you have to pivot, like all, you know, sort of financial or economic investment games. You have to pivot and react to what's happening on the board. If one of these companies, two players push for it and becomes extremely valuable, you suddenly want to be picking up shares on it. You cannot miss out on it. So, you know, there's a market with cards that you can buy during the round using different actions. Some of these cards are, you know, improvements of cards that you already have or exist in the game. Some have resources that allow you to buy more cards. Some of them have shares that you count towards the total of your shares to these companies at the end of the game. But there's also four tracks, one for each company, that get randomized at the start of the game. So there's 10 different tracks. You know, flip some cards or roll dice or whatever, and then at the start of each game, you randomize four of these. One goes to each company, and these tracks, you can start going up. And these tracks get you, that's how you gain more shares in these companies. They get you shares. The further you go up, the more shares you have in these companies, but they also get you special abilities or benefits on top of the shares.
Yeah. That sounds cool because we've discussed before how sometimes games with tracks are just tracks. And I get that from a stock point of view because that's how you score in the game. That's the main point of the game is to invest in these stocks. But having that also give you bonuses kind of ties into this science fiction theme as well. You know, it's stocks in the company, but could you maybe see it as, oh, you've invested in this technology that gives you bonuses? Is that kind of where it's at thematically?
It is. So for instance, there's one of these tracks as soon as you, and they have like certain barriers that you cross. As soon as you cross this barrier, you gain a coin. Coins are points in this game. Then every other player that crosses that barrier gains the same benefit, gains the coin, but you also gain the coin because you invented that first.
Sure.
So that's from a financial perspective, but from a benefits point of view, for instance, there's one track that gets you a +1 energy when you play your energy cards, or it has an exclusive worker placement position that allows you to buy cards cheaper or to, you know, so it gives you things that other players don't have and makes the game much more interesting than just going up the tracks to have more shares and more points at the end of the game. And what I like about it is there's no obvious choice. And I've talked about this a lot in the past. I really love games that do not offer you obvious decisions. I do not like when that happens. And so this game does that because the decision space is big. It, you know, but at the same time, the decision space is very, you have to be very reactive to the board state and the opportunities you have. And these change very frequently. So I think it has some very interesting concepts. Like I said, I haven't played Mombasa, but I understand it's exactly the same game on that side. So you have the map of the moon and these companies build outposts in the different sectors of the moon and gain bonuses and stuff. And then on the other side, if you flip the board on the other side, you have the asteroid belt. And that's when the game changes significantly from Mombasa. When I first played this, I played it two players and I thought it didn't work at all. Because in a two-player game, there's not enough there's just not enough actions that players can do to expand all four companies. There's just not enough actions in the game. And so you kind of end up in a situation where basically one player owns one company and the other player owns another and they kind of fight between them. It becomes almost a different game. Yeah.
I feel like that happens a lot with any games that have got shares involved, though. It's like I've got 20% correct. Of this, you've got 20% of that.
And it's a zero-sum like game. Correct. Yeah, yeah. And I know that we've played an 18XX together, Adrian, at two players. And even that, that has a lot more going on that these kinds of games still has that feel. So I then played, you know, I played at three, I played it at four, and I thought it worked really, really well. It was very interesting. It has a solo mode, which surprisingly seems to be working better than a two-player game. It becomes more of a puzzle. And I think because the solo opponent usually, you know, works like an optimal, does optimal moves, then it forces you to think about things a bit more. Like I said, in a two-player game, it felt like this really should not, you know, work at two players. It didn't thrill me, but in a three and a four player game, and mostly at four, this is very, very interesting. And I think all of you guys would enjoy this one.
Mm. It does sound like a you game. It sounds like Adnan was right. From what you said, I'd be like, if someone had to pick like one of us to play that game, I'd be like, that's a deaf game. So,
yeah. I've not played Sky Mines, but I have played Mombasa. And it's interesting what you say, Def, about the two-player experience being kind of subpar, because I totally agree with respect to Mombasa. But it's interesting you say that, because Sky Mines, one of the things they did was make the board a little tighter to kind of facilitate a better two-player game. But it sounds like it's still got that issue of people just dominating individual companies and there not being enough tension for the kind of area control that occurs in the middle of the board. So that's really interesting.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. The game still works fine. It's still, you know, the same game. It's just you don't feel as excited. Well, I didn't feel as excited playing it. So I think that from what I've read as well is the overall sentiment. So I don't think it's just me. But in any case, this is one of these games. And I usually don't mind playing, you know, a scaled down version of games, because I used to play a lot two-player games with my wife, and I never had an issue with that. But this one specifically, it did not gel very well at two. At four, I had a great time playing it, would love to play it again, but would I play it at two players and even at three? Probably not. But I've enjoyed playing the solo mode, so go figure.
Just play against another solo bot, then you got it at three players.
Yeah, and I just need to print three decks and play against three bots. You can actually do that, but I haven't done that yet. No. So that is Sky Mines from Alexander Pfister.
Amazing. Well, I might go next, because then we've got back-to-back special from 80 with two sizzles. So I'll pop in. I'm going to be talking about a certified classic, which is Through the Desert from Reiner Knizia, the one and only living doctor, which needs a little more love on the pod, if you ask me. So I'm going
to here we go.
Be bringing in some of his classics. Now, I love and own a lot of his games. The reason this one kind of popped to mind is because I got to play a five-player game of it recently, and it was also recently on crowdfunding with a new liquor paint for the game, and I think also a mini expansion with that. With that campaign. But Through the Desert is kind of like Go. Some of those kind of classic stone laying games where we're trying to kind of section off areas of the board. So in Through the Desert, what you're going to do is you've got your little leading camel and you're just going to be making a caravan. So a long line of camels that you're going to be placing on this kind of sprawling hexagonal board to cordon off or section off, cut off parts of the board. And kind of like, I don't know, Go or Othello or one of those, you're going to be scoring for the parts of the board that you've been able to section off. But what is sensational about this game? And I won't talk about it too long because the rules are, I think, one double-sided page. It's a really simple game, is just how cutthroat it is. It is absolutely ruthless because just the placement of a single camel can entirely derail someone's position, can entirely derail someone's gameplay, because there are rules around how you can place your camels. So I'm going to be playing out and kind of trying to section off parts of the board, and I'm going to be trying to get to different watering holes and these different objectives that can get me little things, you know, it's like little modules that you can play with. But if I've placed a camel there, I prevent anyone from placing around me. So you can't kind of meet up with someone else's caravan in that way. So you really kind of can brutally place things just to kind of spite someone. You lock eyes with them across the table as you place down the camel that just absolutely stuffs them. And it goes up to 5. It does play at 2. I wouldn't recommend playing it at 2. It's really a game that the more players, the better.
Yeah.
But there's so much game in it. It's so very simple. You can explain it to just about anyone. And it has what a lot of those really classic Knizia games have, which is just minimal rules overhead with just kind of fitting the most kind of strategy and tension and the biggest decision space with the fewest amount of rules.
Yeah, for
and
sure.
This is one of those games that kind of just has that in spades. Have any of you kind of played this or any of his kind of classic line? I'm getting a lot of
head
shakes.
I haven't played this, but it reminds me of Tron, like the bike bits from Tron. Do you know what I mean? Like you're making Dark lines cross. To cut people off.
What?
Yeah. Like, you know how they drive the bikes and then they cross people off? It's like that. Like you're crossing out people's parts of the map so they can't get past and things like that. But is 5-player too hectic, Lauren? Is 4 better? Is 5-player just insane?
I think it's the same tension, but you just score less, right? Because what you can do on the board is a little more ambitious. I don't think it makes it too hectic. I feel like it's just a lot of personalities to bounce off. Your turns are so lightning quick. I mean, there is some space for analysis paralysis, obviously, with like a lot of these games. But I think 4 and 5 feel really similar. The only thing that I feel changes is your score.
Mm. Okay. Yeah, I haven't played it. I've played Lost Cities is one of my favorites from the time we started in board games and still is. But I haven't played, I don't think, any of his other games. Battle Line I've played, which I think is absolutely fantastic. But not many other Knizia games at all.
Yeah.
What I love about his designs are like they're abstracts, right? Like they're sort of light to mid-weight abstracts. But like you said, there's such low rules overhead that the decision space is all in the board state, effectively. Yeah. It's like, well, what's my best choice to make? All of it is not, oh, let's check the rules. Okay, what's the rulings on that? Or what can and can't do? You're virtually limited by the decision that you are making. And I know you said how it's cutthroat, Lauren, and you know, one placement can ruin it for you. But a lot of the time, that's your own doing. So it's like, well, if I had taken a better option earlier, that would have left me more options. But unfortunately, I picked he chose poorly, as the knight said in Raiders of the Lost Ark. And it's then just ruined your entire game plan. For me, that's table flip worthy, right? Like that makes me so mad. But I'm not mad, and I play games with Def or whatever, and AD and Harry and stuff, and I pretend like I'm mad at them, but I'm not really. I'm mad at myself, and I'm like, Def, it's your fault. Like, why did you do that? When in reality, Def hasn't done anything except trying to improve his position in the game. I'm the idiot that should have taken it a turn early or whatever. So
it's like locomotive in Age of Steam.
I had to go stand against the wall and take some deep breaths after that.
Yes.
But yeah, I'd be really interested in playing this. I think, and Def, you mentioned how you used to play a lot of chess when you were younger. This looks like a very, very good chess alternative, even though you said, Lauren, it's probably better with 3 or 4 players.
Mm. I will clarify as well just a few things. What you said, Adrian, about the different player counts. There's different coloured camel leaders. So everyone starts with 6 different colours, and you have... in the Fantasy Flight version, which I have, these really nice pastel camels, which are really, really lovely. But say you've got a blue, yellow, green, red, whatever it is. And then you have elitis, and then you have a bunch of camels of each of those colors. And you're going to be placing kind of lines of camels of the same color of your leader. So I have a blue leader, Def has a blue leader, Eddie has a blue leader. And so what you're cutting off is you're cutting off the same color for your opponent. So if I place my blue camel here, then now Adrian can't place any of his blue camels around mine because our blues can't touch, but my blue could touch your yellow. And so that's what you're doing when you're cutting people off, is you're kind of also managing these different colors. And in the five-player game, you take out some of the colors. So it helps. There's less caravans kind of moving around for each player. So it helps with the kind of still having enough board space. But the end game trigger is when one person exhausts any color of one of their caravans. So there's also this kind of interesting tension of wanting to, you know, I need to rush and get my blue out this way because I need to cut off Adrian. But also if I do that, then I can't trigger the end game when I want to, or maybe I want to, maybe I want to hold off doing that. So that also is really, again, such a simple rule that adds so much in terms of kind of knowing what to play when and how do I balance it, and add something really interesting to, I guess, the cadence of the game. And yeah, so you're racing to these watering holes because you're trying to connect the different watering holes to get points, and you're trying to cordon off or section off parts of the board because then no one can get there and you're going to score all the hexes that you've sectioned off as points, much like in Go. But yeah, it just a really simple game that if you've not played it, it's definitely worth trying. It's getting reprint now, which is great. So it's going to become more available. I didn't back that because, you know, I already own the Fantasy Flight version, but it's going to be able to get in more people's paws, which is great. So if you see one at retail, pick it up. Through the Desert, Rhino Canizia. Really solid.
Does the new version come with pastel camels?
Honestly, it does not.
Nah.
It does not.
Don't want it then. Absolutely. These pastel ones, they look like little candles and they look amazing to me.
They're absolutely awesome. I love my version. Adrian, you got the two for one special.
Mate, double feature.
Here we go.
So I was lucky enough to play two of the games I've wanted to play for quite a while in a quite sort of close timeline of each other. One was My Oath, which was Shokoku, 1889. And then the other one was Nucleum, which is the David Turtsy Simone Luciani game that got sent to us. Well, I say sent to me by Viola, who is amazing. And in fact, I have to just give a little shout out to Viola for sending me that, because inside the box was a card that just said to Adrian, I love the opportunity to do this for you. Love, Viola. So that was really kind for her to pick me up a copy from Essen, because Simone Luciani is just one of my favorite designers. I love everything that I've played that he's ever done. I love the diversity in his designs. So yeah, I feel really, really privileged to have a copy of that. So that will be the game that I'll talk about first, because I've actually talked briefly about it last time because I had a rule wrong about in the game. And I've actually taught Connor the game. Connor's played it with me online with Harry. And yeah, basically it's a sort of Nucleum is set in an alternative history. In the late 1800s, we found like nuclear energy. So it's kind of branched this timeline off so that, you know, obviously we didn't have nuclear energy in the 1800s. But in this game, we have, and it's a massive sort of industrial race for this energy type, using uranium to power and energize different parts of the city. And I was, initially I played it, and obviously, like I said, I played the rule wrong, but I still enjoyed it. But once we implemented this sort of rule change of how the networks work, it really did blow me away at how good the game is and how annoyingly tight it can be at times and how you can cut people off. So I feel like it's been summarized as barrage meets brass. I see the barrage stuff in the fact that it's asymmetrical and you're playing a different, not a faction, but a different engineer with a different type of experiment that gives you all these asymmetrical abilities, but it's not, I don't feel as is as mean as barrage can be. I feel that you can always pivot in this game to a different direction. And essentially how the game works is you start with these action tiles, and depending on what experiment you do is depending on what action tiles you start with. And there's four different experiments to choose from, which essentially is your engineer who's creating this particular experiment. And the only main difference between each one is your technologies that you have available to you are different depending on which engineer you're playing or which scientist you're playing. So there's the four different experiments, and they make you different to each other. And that's pretty much where the asymmetrics come into it. So the reason why I find this game really interesting is because the action tiles that you use, you can use them in different ways. So as an example, on your player board, you can place the action tile in your player board, which allows you to take both actions or one of the actions on that tile, because each tile has two actions. If you do both actions and it sits there in your player board, it stays there until you refresh. At some point in the game, when you refresh and recall, you pull the tiles out. Depending on how far your income tracks are and how far your action tiles are, is how much income you're going to gather to take further turns in the game, which is great. It's sort of, you know, place out the action tile, do the actions. When you've got a limited amount of actions left, or there's some actions you don't really want to take, you recall, you get everything back, which is fantastic, and then you get your income, so you get yourself sort of ahead a bit for your next turn. But, however, when you want to build networks in the game, because the game is essentially different cities all connected by different railway networks, those action tiles on the back side have a railway track on them. So rather than using them as an action tile, you place them out on the map where you want to develop your network. Place one of your workers on that tile to denote that is my tile. You get to take the action that connects to the city, because the tile itself is split into two, like a domino. You have a top half and a bottom half. You do the action. On a further turn or a subsequent turn, if a player connects to your tile and matches the same color, they can take the action connected by the color, but then you take the action that you missed out on because they have then connected to you, completing the chain. And a lot of the towns and cities require one tile. So sometimes you have the perfect tile. It's a green on one side and a white on the other side, and you can place that in. You get to take both actions and flip it over immediately to become a railway track. But you've lost that action tile for the rest of the game. So essentially, your actions, you need to buy more of them. And there is a market and an action for that. It's called develop. You take the develop action, you go to a space, and you can buy all these action tiles, but they're upgraded, modified versions of the same action tiles, but just better. They're generally better. Some of them aren't as good. Some of them are different. They just do different things. But each tile has like that domino effect where it's like orange at the top, green on the bottom. And if you're placing it out on the map, you want to match it, or you want other players to match it. There are wild tiles, which generally speaking don't have as powerful action on them, but they're so versatile that when you place them out on the board, you get to do the bonus anyway. So that's really the first sort of action sort of selection, is using those tiles to place them out on your player board, where you get to take both actions and recall them so you keep them, or you place them on the map to develop these networks. Now, you need to develop the networks because you can get blocked out by other players if you do not have a network that's connected, or do not have meeples or workers on that train line leaving your city. So that's where the sort of barrage-y, almost brassy element comes into it. You need to be connected to these things. If you're not connected to them, you're going to miss out. So I found that really, really interesting. So that's just the action tiles, but the action tiles themselves, they have, like I said, develop to buy more action tiles. You've got contracts where you can pick up different contracts. When you place the contracts on your player board, you get a bonus depending on where you slot them into your player board. You have urbanize, which is when you build the buildings. So you build these buildings out on the map. And the objective of the game is to actually power these buildings and energize these buildings. So you don't really get much benefit for building the building itself. The benefit comes in when you energize them. And how you can energize them is you can, at the start of the game, pay money to use coal, because there's a coal market that's off the board. And essentially they're like these little coal tiles. And once you've used one, you flip it. So it becomes, it was a dollar and now it's $2. So anyone that needs to take it on a subsequent turn, they've got to pay $2 to buy that coal. Once all the $2 ones have been used, underneath them printed on the board is a $3 coal. And that's so expensive. By that point of the game, you really don't want to be using coal unless you just want to use one coal just to get enough power to energize a building. So there's also not only urbanized where you build the buildings, there's also industrialized. Now, the industrialized thing is another set of building types. You have turbines and mines. Their only way to get them on the board is by doing the industrialized action. And there's different places on the board, and you don't want to get locked out from the mines, because as Connor found out a little early, probably a bit too cruel for that earlier point in the game, but if I didn't do it, he was going to do it, and then he would have locked me out, and then I wouldn't have been able to build a mine. So I lost an action tile. I've just placed it out because I didn't care, because I couldn't get locked out of that area. And then it took me a little while to get those action tiles back again, because I obviously lost an action tile, and that action tile was the tile that had the develop action, which was to buy more tiles. So I was then a bit stuck for a little while.
Would you say this is as punishing as Barrage for newcomers, or do you feel like it's more gentle?
No.
Nah, I'll jump in and say I don't think so, because your options aren't as limited. And as I'm sure Adrian will explain in a second, the way that you score victory points is different than in Barrage, where if you get locked out of a particular position, you've got to totally pivot and then go from there. Whereas you can sort of, you know, I found it nowhere near as punishing as the first time I played Barrage.
Yeah, I agree. It's not as punishing. It's just, there's, I think in this game, you can always pivot and you can always get stuff and get into stuff. You just, in Barrage, like there's some rounds where you just get locked out and you cannot get back into the game. It takes so long. It takes an entire round of the game to get back. Whereas this game, there are no rounds. You just keep playing and playing and playing until you recall. Excuse me. And when you recall, you then basically place a star out on the on this sort of victory point system, which basically, depending on how far up and how much energy you've created, or how, not how much energy you've created, how many buildings you've powered, sorry, you get these awards for doing it, these achievement tokens. And then when you call back and recharge, you spend all your achievement tokens and you go up this sort of scale. And the higher you go up is the higher the multiplier is. But the multiplier is for the current goal, the current milestone. And that can change from game to game. Just like in Barrage at the end of round, which is different. It's the same sort of system. It could be how many buildings you've got energized. It could be how many meeples you've got out on the map because you've laid track. And it's a multiplier of that. And each time you play the game, it's completely different. So you're aiming for those goals and those objectives. But there's an interesting sort of threshold in that, and the fact that depending on where you sit and depending how high you go up that track, because it's a colored system, it goes like green through to orange, potentially you could get 5 times, let's say, buildings energized, but you could also get 4 times buildings energized. So you could potentially get 9 times multiplier for that one thing, yeah, okay, because of the color banding. It's really interesting. And I really like that, pushing that limit to try and get yourself into those bands and then just hammering that particular victory, that victory point objective. But it does have a lot, enough player interaction, but not too much. It's not like Barrage where you just cutthroat, yeah, as, and you feel like you're getting dogged all the time. There's enough in it to enjoy it still, but there's some kind of co-op element to it as well, because when you're building the railway tracks, sometimes you're like, man, if I don't jump onto this now, one, I'm going to get blocked out, and two, Connor's going to move his income track marker so far up. It's really a good idea to get in on this now and complete the track rather than Connor completing the track as an example.
So. Have you played it at different player counts, Adrian? And how does it scale?
I've played it solo 3 times. Oh. I don't usually solo game, but it's really good. I really like it. I love how it works, how it functions, and I love how the bot works. It does have one of those charts, you know, the chart where it's like, if bot doesn't sure. have this, go there. You know, like, I don't know if that's in everything, but I know it's in Barrage. And it's easier than the Barrage one. I'll give it that. It's really simple. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not even that hard to use. And one of the action tiles that I forgot to mention, you cannot use it as track. You always have to keep it. And it doesn't allow you to do 2 actions. It allows you to just do 1 action at a dollar discount. And basically, the bot's actions, they just sit there in front of you. And that tile starts at the right-hand side. And as you use his actions, they start to go over to the left-hand side of it. And eventually, that comes to the front. And that's one of the parameters. It's like, is that tile at the front? Yes, it is. Then do this. And a different thing happens. I've played it at 3 players and 4 players. I think because in the game isn't as grueling or punishing as even Brass, to be honest, when people are stealing your beers and stuff, like that's pretty punishing, but and Barrage, but it, because there's enough to do and enough space to pivot, I don't feel it's you're losing out by having 3 or 4, and the map
okay.
accommodates that. So on the back side, there is a 1 and 2 player map. And then the other side is 3 and 4. So you've got all the player counts and the map's a little bit smaller on the 1 to 2.
Yeah.
And on the 3 player map, what happens is you draw cards to set up the game.
Okay. So there's a
start. You lock out mines and lock out turbine spaces and stuff like that. So.
Is there one part of the game, Adrian, that you feel like stands out mechanically? So, for example, when Depp was talking about Sky Mines, he mentioned the management of the hands and your discard piles is kind of the mechanic that I agree for Mombasa totally stands out for that game. Do you feel like Nucleum has something like that, or is it just really a solid mix of kind of tried and true Euro mechanisms that just work well together in this game?
Well, it has those solid mechanisms, like you said, and it really does. And you have all these technology upgrades and other things that, you know, give you these end game scorings. I think it has the way that the networks work and the way you score at the end of the game is really interesting. It's not the same as Brass Birmingham, but it's attuned to it, I would say. But I feel like the way the power management works, the way turbines work, it is really interesting because you can essentially, once you recall in the game, you put your marker up on the score track, like I said, and that's your multiplier. The first player that does that gets to take a Nucleum cube from that range and place it into the power stations that have no power, and they're a Nucleum station. They're waiting to be energized. And once you've done that, you don't have to buy coal anymore. You can use your uranium. But the interesting thing is you can only put 1 uranium cube through the power station unless you build turbines. Any player can build a turbine on that area as long as their network's connected to it. But every time you use a uranium cube through that system, you have to pay them a dollar, kind of like the conduits in Barrage. But as you go back to your question, I think playing your action tiles as networks is the most unique part and also the most brain-burning bit, because you're like, do I want to lose this action? I'm probably going to have to take 2 steps back, but at least I'm still on that network. At least I haven't been locked out, which is probably worse for me long run than losing this tile sort of thing. Yeah,
that sounds cool.
I think that would be the most interesting part. In a 4-player game, that's more prevalent because all of the networks, the maximum size is 3. There are no 4 networks. So someone's going to get locked out, which is more grueling and more punishing. But like I said, and Connor said, you can pivot in this game to the nth degree. So you can usually, you're usually fine.
When's it coming to Australia?
I think January. It's not too far off. I really enjoyed it. And I love games where you build and you develop. And then, I mean, you get to energize the buildings and power them up. And when you power the buildings up, you get these bonuses and these other different benefits. And then you're collecting all these sort of achievement tokens. So then when you recall, you can then spend it and go right up on that track. So you're getting a massive multiplier for an end game condition that you are pivoting to. I really enjoy the game. It's really, really, really solid. It's definitely up there with the best games I've played this year.
Sounds like right up our alley. And
yeah,
my brother's got a copy in Greece and he's bringing it to me when it arrives next week. So that's going to be exciting.
Yeah. You'll love it. I think you'll really enjoy it.
Sounds like.
What did you think, Connor, on the whole? Because you played it.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I can see where people would say, like you said, 80, it's a mix between Brass and Barrage. I feel like the Barrage side has the parts that people would enjoy from Barrage, with the energizing being similar to making the energy in Barrage with using the water as a resource. In terms of it being punishing in Barrage and in Brass, the resources are somewhat limited, whereas in Nucleum, the uranium only you can access from your mine. So you cannot steal uranium from my mine. I cannot steal it from yours. The coal is unlimited, only limited by the amount of money you're willing to pay. You moving and making something part of your network is not that punishing. You can place those tracks down wherever you want. It just means it's not connected to your initial network, if you want to think of it that way. So you can spread out and place your tracks wherever you would like, but it is disconnected from your network until it becomes connected. And you are sort of, it's your behooven to then not let someone totally dominate a track. We let Harry do that. And he got so many points based on that. So his point income just shot right up. We couldn't catch him with that. It helped him out so much. But the energizing, for a bit, I was like, well, what's the point? Why are we doing this? Why are we energizing? And then, like you said, it gives you bonuses once the buildings are energized. And also, that's based, your massive end of game scoring is based on whether those bottom rung buildings are energized or not, and then how many buildings are energized itself. I had heaps of fun. The asymmetry, while not overly prevalent, is enough to make it interesting. We had decisions of whether to go on one side or another side with our technologies. Is that right?
We could pick. I let you pick which experiment.
Yes,
you wanted
that's
to do,
right.
Which is the side of the, which was essentially, you know, your faction your that made you asymmetrical, and they are all very different, which is quite interesting to play.
And the game can end in a variety of ways because there's certain end game triggers depending on how the game is being played. So you could push to finish your experiment if you think someone's one or two turns away from having a really big network turn. Because what you can do is there's some actions that allow you to build twice in one turn at a discount. Mm. And then normally I ended up with this really cool power, which I probably got too late, where I could build anywhere on the board. It didn't have to be part of my network. I could build anywhere, which ended up being really cool to get buildings out. But because they weren't part of my network, I couldn't energize them. So it was a decision of, am I going to push to get these out, or am I just going to, you know, try and have my nice little cluster. So yeah, I really enjoyed it. Again, I would like to play it again. I only played it the once, but it's definitely a good mix. I really enjoy Brass, and I really, really enjoy Barrage as well. And they're not types of games that I would have played before coming part of this podcast. So yeah, that's been really good for me.
Amazing. So do you want to tell us about your second sizzle, Adrian?
Is that the game you have spent the most time in your life preparing for? Yeah. No, that was a quick confirmation.
People train for marathons. Adrian trains for teaching 18XXs.
That's it.
Look, I didn't. Def does it really well. Like, he's a very good teacher, and it's something that I am not that great at. Like, I'm fine once I know the game very well and I've played it a couple of times, but if I haven't played it a couple of times, I just don't remember. I'm not good enough at remembering. And I've had some bad experiences getting taught games where you are there for hours and it's not an enjoyable thing. And I don't want to put a group of people through a 5.5 hour 18XX game, which can creep up to an 8 hour quite quickly if we're not doing it properly and if not everybody understands what we're doing. So I did do a lot of prep. I watched a couple of videos. I played it online solo, like two-handed solo a couple of times. I played it on my table a few times, two-handed and three-handed solo, just like one round, just to double check that everything's moving correctly. And that is 1889 Shikoku, which was the first 18XX game I bought. It was a Kickstarter exclusive, I believe, but it's definitely a Kickstarter game. It was touted as the easiest, most entry-level 18XX game. And after playing some of the ones I've played with Def, I can definitely see that. And it comes through really well. It's a very easy to learn and get things moving once you understand some basic concepts of 18XX. So I'm not going to say, you know, my mum who's only ever played Scrabble, you're going to be able to be fine, just grab this, here you go. Like, there are some basic concepts about shares and paying out dividends and withholding and things like that that you just need to understand to play this game. But that's all written in the rules. The rule book was fantastic. I have to give them massive kudos for the rule book. It was really simple to read, really easy to learn. And yeah, it was a really good 18X experience. I had Dana, Felicity, Alex, who've never played any 18XX, and then Matt, who had only played the old prince at your house, Def.
Yep, I remember that.
And
the banker.
Yeah, the banker. Hate that guy.
I hope you didn't let him win.
I can't even remember who won now off the top of my head. But it was a really interesting game because it is basic in its concept. There's no crazy
shenanigans.
You're not gonna have a company that can then buy more companies or split itself and be owned by different parts of different companies, and there's not different licenses or agreements. There's no cost to laying any track or anything. It's just you only have to pay if you're building on the mountains, sure, and you know, rough terrain or across the river, but you can lay track anytime you like and you don't pay. So Shikoku, the reason why I'm sizzling it and I thought it was a great game is because it really was brilliant for people who have not played 18XX
before. Yeah, that's great.
And I do feel that there's enough enjoyment in this for me to teach this game a couple more times and get enjoyment out of it. Like, still, it's not ridiculously basic. It still has those core values that make an 18XX game interesting. I do like in this game, so a lot of these games, when you own private companies at the start of these games, they give you a small benefit and a small amount of income, which is really cool. But the reason why I like the ones in this game is that when you start the game, everyone gets the equal amount of money, which is $390 yen. And you place these private companies from A to F at the side of the board. And essentially what happens is you bid on the first one, right? The A. But as it comes around the bidding, when it becomes my turn, I might not want the A. I have a different plan. So I can reserve a bid that's 5 yen greater than the face value of the private company on any of the ones that are coming up in the future. So let's say the E, which is the Doju Rail, which gives you a benefit that's different to the other ones and a different type of income and all this other stuff. You can actually trade it in later in the game for 10% share in a particular company. So I might reserve a bid on that, and no other player reserves a bid on it or anything. And when it comes down to that card, no one bids on it. Because I placed my bid on it and no one else reserved a bid to match me, I just get it at $5 above the value. So it sort of, you need to look forward at what's valuable and what's not. And I really enjoyed that start of the game because I hadn't done that before. And it made it different. Everyone's got these different companies that you start the game with, and away you go. So some basics on how the 18X system works for anyone that hasn't played before. Essentially, you're managing a train company as a player. You're a private investor. And if you have the predominant share of that company, as long as it's over 50% shares, it's floated and the company operates, which means trains run on the track, you get income. You control what happens with that money as you're the predominant shareholder of the company. And when that happens, you can either pay out dividends to the shareholders and give them all their money, and that's great. Shareholders love that. Or you can withhold the money within the company to buy more trains and do other upgrades that need doing for the company later on. It's important that the company still has money to function and buy more things, but it's also important to pay the dividends out and get your money out of the company, because you don't win the game if your company's got $1 billion. It's your personal funds that matter at the end of the game. And I thought about 2/3 of the way through the game, I would get cocky and try something which led me to complete bankruptcy. And I almost lost. If anyone gets bankrupt in the game, you're out. Done. Finished. And I got another company and I thought, oh, other people invest. I think it'll get floated. Nobody invested in it at all. And then by the time it floated, the train price was so expensive, the company couldn't afford a train. So it forced me to pay for the train out of my personal stash, of which there wasn't a lot. I paid it, I got it over the line, and then because I bought that train, the other company I owed, its train rusted out because I bought the first train for the next one, which caused that train company to have no trains. Therefore, I had to dump shares and all my companies to get the money to buy a train for that company. And it just took me out of the game. I was out. By that point, I knew I was done.
The pained look on Def's face just then of him like, how could you let that happen? You ingrate.
Well, I played a game of 1830 a couple of months ago, and I went bankrupt in that game. So, you know, I know how it feels.
It's so painful because I saw the player buy that train and I was like, that was the only thing that was going to ruin my strategy, and it happened and I can't do anything about it. And yeah, it was still good. It's a good experience. I won't do it again. I'll be a little bit more cautious at trying to start a second company 2/3 of the way through the game. But Shikoku itself, for anyone that's interested in the 18XX system, there's obviously Chesapeake, which is its kind of counterpart. They are both very similar. I wouldn't say one was easier than the other. They are both very, very similar in their core values. They're designed to get people into the 18XX system, and they both do it remarkably well. I will say, however, the Shikoku game does look very nice. Like they really went above and beyond with the map and stuff. It looks very pretty for an 18XX.
So what is it about this game that you think makes it appealing for people who haven't played 18XX? Because obviously it's a very kind of different way of thinking. So almost for these styles of games, the first play is going to be a bit of a wash. So I guess, yeah, what is it about that you feel like makes this one much more beginner friendly?
Well, I could learn it and teach it, so it's got to be pretty easy, like, to be fair. But like, I mean, I think it's just that there's, in a lot of the other ones, there's a lot of other overheads that you need to keep on top of. So you're constantly tracking data and information that, you know, it might be like, oh, well, you can't go there because you haven't got that type of license, or this can't happen because of X, and you've got to pay to upgrade the track or build track, yeah, and it costs this, and your company's paying it out. Whereas this, you don't have any of that to worry about. It's just place a piece of track on the board, or on your turn, you can upgrade a piece of track. No cost, no hassle. You just, you know, you get to do those things. Whereas, you know, if you were playing a slightly more advanced game, you'd have to think, okay, well, have I got the budget for that? Have I, and that's another thing to be worrying about, whereas mm-hmm. it just takes all of that out. You don't need to worry about that, which is great.
Is it also meant to be a little bit shorter than, I mean, 18 Chesapeake, one of the criticisms is that it's a long game for starting 18XX. Chicago is meant to be shorter. I don't know what your experience was.
I think the next time it will definitely be shorter. The next time I teach it as well, but it was 5 hours all up. Teach, played, done, finished. Okay. Which I think is acceptable.
Not bad, yeah.
For three people who've never played it before.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
For me, who's never taught one before, like there was a few hiccups along the way. Nothing major. Mainly Dana laundering her own money through her own companies, which was quite funny. But yeah, I think Dana enjoyed it as well. Like she definitely mentioned that she'd definitely try it again and like to try it again. So yeah, that's the plus, I think.
That's awesome. Could you reduce the size of the bank just to make the game shorter?
Yeah, I mean, you could. I don't think there would be a hard and fast rule against it. You could start with 6,000, but it's like all those engine builders. Once stuff starts to get interesting and fun and good, all of a sudden the game's finished and you're like, crap. No, not now. I'm just about to make I'm going to make bank.
Yeah.
And it's kind of funny because at the start of it, you're making like $6 and $4. And then by the end, it's like $237. And you're like, woohoo. And everyone's excited because it's getting these big stacks of chips like dumped in front of them. So no, it was a great game. I'm looking forward to teaching it again, actually, because it's so simple that I could probably just start the teacher by even reading the rule book again, and away we go. So
amazing. Yeah, I'd love to give it a try. I've not played an 18XX, but I played the Iron Rails series, Irish Gauge. So that kind of flavor. But yeah, that's really awesome. All right. So now some announcements and news. So the hosts will be counting down our top 10 games of all time over the next two episodes. So keep your ears peeled for that. Those will be coming to you on your various podcast apps. Then we're going to be taking a break for 2 weeks over the Christmas New Year period, and we'll be back in 2024. But if you are a Patreon, you will have access to many of the hosts' top 50 via our Patreon episodes. So if you want to have a listen to those, then you can join us on Patreon. The Sydney Game Day is coming up, 9th of December. So get your tickets for that if you haven't already. And then we've got the Brisbane Game Day, which is December 30th, which is 10 a.m. to 2 a.m. So happy New Year's Eve to all you up in Brisbane. And that'll be at the Westside HQ in Corinda.
If you're looking to add to your board game collection without taking out a second mortgage, then look no further than Advent Games. Dean and the team don't just sell games, they play games, they know games, they love games, just like us. The first thing you notice when you head to adventgames.com.au is the amazing range of games. Dean and the team have worked tirelessly to make sure that every game is properly catalogued into the website. You can search by card games, dice games, family games, gateway games, solo games, and games from your favourite designers. And they don't just have games. Advent has a huge range of RPG books, game inserts, organisers, sleeves, even miniatures and scenery to make your next game night an experience to remember. Shipping is a flat $10 if you live in the Sydney metro area, $15 for the rest of Australia. And don't forget, if you sign up for their newsletter, every Friday you receive an email with the latest specials, newest arrivals, and a list of all the games that have just come back into stock. So there's no excuse for missing out on that game that you desperately want in your collection. So why not grab your next sizzling game from Advent Games? Head to adventgames.com.au now.
All right, now on to question of the pod. So our question of the pod for last week was, What other hobbies do you have outside of board gaming? So, Def, I'll flick over to you if you want to read some of the responses from Facebook of people who seem to do something else in their free time other than play board games, which is shocking.
How is this possible? I don't understand. Allison Wiley says, cliche, I know, but as a nana, I love knitting for my grandkids. Allison put up a pic of her latest knitting, which is fantastic. Simon Matthew says, generally getting out hiking, kayaking, or sailing. This year I've been learning boat buildings too.
That was so cool. He put up a picture of the boat he was building. That was unreal. I saw that.
That's amazing.
I'm almost inclined to ask, okay, so, you know, what kind of game can you get on a kayak?
Too many bones.
Yeah.
Ryan David says beer brewing, which is pretty exciting. Ryan Harlan says pinball machines, remote control trucks, marine aquariums, and drones. And Ian Third said fencing, diving, and flying, which sounds interesting. And I want to ask questions about flying.
And fencing.
Do all three at the same time.
Three at the same time.
Yeah.
I want to know what marine aquariums, is that building them? Is that managing the things in them?
Goes on holiday in an aquarium.
All right, Connor, do you want to read some of the ones from Discord?
Sure. So our good buddy Rainier has listed quite an extensive one. So remote controlled /e-cars and motorbikes, miniature painting, which he admits is a board game spin-off, disc golf, which then led to a minor discussion between what's that and Frolf. So go check that out on Discord if you haven't already. 3D printing, which was initially not a board game spin-off. Various project on Raspberry Pi and Arduino platform, surveillance systems, fun projects, face recognition, robotics, and then building my own furniture or whatever I feel like, e.g. board game multifunctional table, including Malkin Mini Z train system.
I saw a photo of that. That looked bonkers.
Yeah.
That looked crazy.
Yeah, insane.
So he says, I get every second month a crafting box, an engineering box. And then finally, just because he doesn't want to leave the arts out, creating stained glass objects. Rainier's also given us a bunch of custom dice as well, which is like, it's easy to do. And I'm like, for you. JB says, I am a football fan. The real football with the round ball. So them's fighting words. I still play football at the tender age of 48. I'm a big Arsenal and France fan. I love reading fantasy books. I also like playing PC games, mainly with my son at the moment. And then Matt Snake Oz says, Lego would be my next most expensive hobby. Then I have reading and playing PlayStation. I should get back into scuba diving maybe one day. Maybe he can join up with Ryan Harlan and they can go on a marine aquariums trip.
Man, Lego is an expensive hobby, though.
Yeah.
Some of those kits. The Rivendell one, have you seen it?
Yes. Oh, don't worry. Amazing. I was in Denmark, and the only reason it did come home with me is because I had no space in my luggage.
And you can buy lights as well that kind of fit into the Lego sets. They light up. Unreal.
So good. Light kits, by the way.
So from Twitter, Pack the Maniac says, besides playing games, board games, PC and console, I really like enjoying nature, including going on a tour with my canoe. And also Pack sent in a photo from his boat trips in the south of Germany, which looked beautiful. And then on Instagram, One Single Meeple, I'm a competition swimmer. Other than that, I learn Japanese, read manga, watch anime, do cross stitch, knotless needle binding, and make greeting cards. Busy, busy.
Mm.
Wow. Alrighty, now on to our new question of the pod. So in the lead up to the members of the podcast doing their own top 10 board games of all time, we'd love to hear from you. What are your top 5 games of all time? Because we know your 6 through 10 are going to be trash games. Top 5.
We don't care.
What are they?
Jokes, we do.
We want the meat.
Yeah.
Yeah. The real meat and bones. Yeah.
The seafood of the marinara. That's what we want. We don't want the pasta. We just want the prawns, the mussels.
We want the burnt ends. We want the corner of the brownie. We want the icing on the cake. Your top
part. Ah, the corner of the brownie. You think that's a good bit?
That's the best part.
Of course, bro, you can get those things that make all corner pieces.
What?
Yeah, this is not a controversial. Like
that's all dry. That's all dry.
Chewy.
And crunchy.
It's awesome when you put a dollop of ice cream on it. Oh.
Okay. Well, Adrian can also give his 6 through 10 middle brownie piece.
Yeah, I'll have the center all the way around, all center bits.
That's not how it works, Adrian. If you can invent that, okay, then amazing.
Amazing.
Are we listing our top five? I suppose it's a bit silly, isn't it?
So. Well, this is one question of the pod where we can't discuss because we're doing our top tens next week.
So. I can say that there's definitely a shake-up in my list. I can say that.
As a shake-up in my list, kind of.
I'm not. It's not the same 10. Like It's not the same 10 games as last year. So
that's very good.
You other two, do you have kind of lots of shake-ups in your list?
Oh, I've started doing. I'm one of the people that have been doing the Patreon eps, so it's been interesting listening to different people's. And it'd be interesting to hear yours, Lauren, because it's been interesting hearing Dana's being new members. So yeah, that's what I'm looking forward to at least.
Yeah, I had the pub meeple going last night trying to get my top 50 together so I can record them. But I think the jostling for the top spot, it kind of feels almost arbitrary. It's like Sophie's Choice with each of those pairings. Some of them were brutal.
I sent Def a few pictures of when I was doing it, and I'm sure he's like, oh, sweet summer child. Only you knew what I had to go through.
I will say, I think my list will be very different to people on the pod.
That's what we want.
That's great.
We like that.
Get some bit of variety in there. Alrighty. So a few shout outs to some of our Patreons. Thank you to Paul Grogan, Shane RC, Tina Hansen, and David Walsh. Thank you so much for your support. It absolutely means the world. If you want to support this podcast, you can always go to patreon.com/boardgamebarbecue, sign up to donate, get access to exclusive episodes like our top 50. We've released some of the Christmas eps from last year. So as well, if you haven't checked those out, you can listen to those, get a flavor for those Patreon episodes. But if you don't want to support us there, there are lots of other ways that you can support us. You can go to Apple Podcasts, leave a star rating and a review for us, or on Spotify's new star rating system. It only takes a few seconds, but it means the world to us. And you can also get involved in the community. So join us on Facebook, on Discord, Twitter, Instagram. There's always chats happening there, so we'd love to hear from you there.
Actually, as well, we gave away one of last year's episodes for free. Connor and I talking rubbish about the best TV shows of 2022. Because it's kind of become our annual thing that we do the TV thing together, and it's been quite fun. So this year's was great.
Yeah, it was awesome.
There's so much good TV. But like last year's was quite good to, you know, give that to everybody else so they can reminisce about last year's TV stuff. So,
all right, now we're on to swearing of an oath. So I will start us off real quick. I can say that I was successful in my pairing of oaths. Thank you so much to Adrian for helping me out with the Clans of Caledonia expansion. Like we've said before.
Thoughts on reflection?
Yeah, look, it's nothing new. It's nothing groundbreaking. They definitely still need to do a bit of work tweaking the balance of those new clans. But if you like the game, I can't see any reason why you wouldn't want to pick up this expansion. It's just more variety, more variability. Some of those kind of port tiles in the corner are absolutely nuts in the new one. Yeah. So I don't know if they'll have to kind of nerf those a bit. But yeah, just more of what is already a great game. I also got the chance to play the backstage expansion for Shakespeare. Shakespeare is a quite out of print Euro game. It's pretty light. Essentially what you're doing in Shakespeare is you are just trying to put on the best play. So you have these decks of actors that you're playing out. You're trying to kind of also do set design to build tiles to place a set on your stage. which is just, yeah, really lovely theme. If you like English literature, I think you'll find the theme really charming. All of the actor cards are different characters from Shakespeare's plays, and it's got, you know, their names on the sides, and it just really visually appealing. The art's lovely. The backstage expansion doesn't add a lot. It's just a little extra deck of cards. But now that I've played with it, I absolutely wouldn't play without it. I don't know how easy that expansion is to get, but it's already a game that's pretty hard to get anyway, if I'm honest. So I know that Dean from Advent, he had the backstage expansion on sale for a little bit. I actually picked mine up from him. But essentially, kind of, it just gives players a little more breathing space, a little more in terms of options, and adds just a bit of extra depth. Won't go too much into it, but yeah, just really great, I think, an essential expansion because it's so easy to slot in and I'd never play without it. And I also finished Pandemic Legacy Season 1, which was a game that started in 2020.
This massive effort. Well done.
It knows party poppers up.
Oh, man. And now, I kid you not, on my two watch list on YouTube for the past 3 years have been all these spoiler-filled reviews of Pandemic Legacy Season 1, which I can now actually finally go and watch. So, got all that content on there, which is great. Yeah, brilliant. Won't say anything about it because don't want to spoil it. There are twists and turns. It's really good. Obviously, it's ranked so high for a reason. Yeah. My new oath, I was going to make a Pandemic Legacy Season 0, but I'm not going to do that to myself. What I am going to do is I think I will make an oath to play The Artisans of Splendent Vale, which is a game that we had come in from crowdfunding a little bit ago, which James and I have not got the chance to play because we've been trying to finish up our Gloomhaven campaign, which we're wrapping up this year. So Artisans of Splendent Vale is basically like a choose your own adventure kind of campaign style game. It's got these books that each character has that you'll kind of flick to based on what's occurring. So everyone will kind of have a different take on the story by Nikki Valens. So that's my new oath, is to at least kind of get started on our campaign of Artisans of Splendent Vale. Connor, no surprises here. You've done your oath.
I have. So spoilers, no spoilers from the beginning of the show. I did, thankfully to Def, play Voidfall. So I'm excited to play my own version now with all the bits and bobs. That's really good. I believe, if Ozpost is to be believed, that I'll be getting a card game similar to my number one game of all time, Arkham Horror Limited card game.
Surely
in the
not.
Post, and that's Earthborn Rangers. So Lauren's just having a conniption over there. So I believe mine's coming this week, supposedly. It could be something else, but it should be here by the time I'm on the show next. So my oath is to play Earthborn Rangers.
Yeah. Adrian, how'd you go with yours?
Shikoku, taught it to Dana, went really well. Everyone knows the rest. But for me, all this talk of Voidfall has me wanting to play the game that I backed at a similar time as Voidfall, and I chose to go a different path, and that was another Luciani game, and that's Anunnaki, or Anunnaki. Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
There's so much. I can't remember which one the right one is anymore. I prefer Anunnaki, so I'm going with that. And I
how to pronounce it.
Yeah. I really loved the playtesting of this game. This is a game that I playtested a lot, and I just haven't got it to the table just for sheer, you know, being so busy for up to Christmas. But I'm really looking forward to playing it. It's another one of those 4X Euro games. So, yeah. It's got a great action selection puzzle, which I think everyone here would really enjoy. I know Connor's played it multiple times, so he enjoys it. So, yeah, that's it.
Awesome. And Def, what do you got for us?
My offer was to play 20 Strong, which was the small game from Chip Theory Games, which I've done and had a lot of fun with it so far. And it's, you know, it's a small box game, quick to set up, quick to play 30 minutes. The variance between the decks is big. And I see this being played a lot in these, you know, nights that you don't have enough time, so short sessions. So pretty happy with the game. And as far as a new oath is concerned, I think I'm going to go with a big one because I have to. And that's to play one of the two 18XX games I have that I haven't played yet, and that's 1846. It's also meant to be one of the most popular ones in the 18XX community, so very much looking forward to playing this.
Amazing. So that next step, 18XX game, probably not so intro friendly. Alrighty. Awesome. Well, thanks so much for chatting, guys. That was great. Great mix of games, some light games, some heavy games, everything in the middle.
Thank you.
And
thanks, Loz.
Yeah, cheers, guys. And we'll catch you next week for our 10 through 6 top 10 games of all time.
Woo!
Woo. All right, see ya.
See you, guys.
Cheers.
Bye.